We get the 5 o'clock hour rolling like we do every single Tuesday afternoon as we welcome into the show our friend Colin Fleming. And I'm going to say it, with James Brown's dead, I think Colin may now be the hardest working man in show business. Colin, welcome back.
Effort is misleading. That's what everyone always says to someone who's really productive. But I would suggest it's probably about other things than that.
You have got a couple of different pieces out right now on Miles Davis, John Coltrane, Jazz Times, the cover story, and a terrific piece on the Daily Beast as well.
Yeah, today it's like you're the band leader in our little setup, and I'm the tenor man. But yes, those would be pieces on, well, one is a box set, the Jazz Times one, about the final live recordings made, any recordings really, with John Coltrane, Miles Davis over in Europe, and then the Daily Beast piece is on the nature of musician autobiographies and how there tends to be really no middle room. They're either rubbish, like a horrible commercial, kind of like, and then we did this, and this album came out and reached number two, or they're pretty virtuosic in terms of their writing, which I think makes a certain kind of sense. And specifically, Miles Davis's autobiography as the best one ever written by a popular musician.
And you say a big reason is that, is not often the case in these musician or entertainer autobiographies, there's a clear voice in Miles Davis's writing.
There is a very clear voice. In fact, I was at the symphony the other day over at Symphony Hall, and a friend was there, and he buttonholed me in the hallway, and he said, wait, isn't Miles Davis's autobiography just him telling everyone how great he is? There's kind of a lot of that, but I think there's a very close relationship for musicians between something we've talked about in the past, sound and sense. I think you could also say the same thing about John Keats, Rep. Scott Fitzgerald, the way that their language possessed the musicality. So in this instance, we're sort of working from the other direction towards language. And Miles Davis definitely had a lot of voice. He had a lot of voice as a writer. He had a lot of voice were you to meet him. He had a lot of voice as a trumpet player, as a composer, as a trumpet player who used a harmon mute in a way that gave his voice an extra element of voice, but yeah, lots of voice with this guy.
And an intensity, too, you mentioned, that you don't often find in these works.
No, there's like one incident where he is riding in the back of like some car with some socialite type of woman, and they're going off to some awards ceremony. And she says to him basically, oh, why are you here? What have you done? And he responds by saying, okay, white lady, I've basically reinvented music like seven times, which is true because he's one of those people like a Picasso, a Melville, a Dylan, an Orson Welles, a Beatles, where they don't have a sort of stylistic calling card that we can point to. He did like cool jazz in the late 40s after having been a part of the early bebop movement. Did modal jazz later, did kind of a post-hard bop after that, did jazz as chamber music, fusion, electro-funk jazz, and the whole white lady thing, he could have been sitting with the Hamburglar, and he would have taken its head off in the same exact way. But yeah, he was, one word I used to describe him once was virulent. He was not someone who would maybe excel in PC culture, but I think like politically correct language is often a cover up for intellectual a sort of deficiency, really. And he was a plain speaker because he had a lot to say.
We're talking with Colin Fleming here on Downtown. Let's discuss the piece in Jazz Times on Miles Davis and John Coltrane, the final tour of the bootleg series, and the relationship between Davis and Train, which was, not always a smooth one between those two.
No, it frequently wasn't. Some of that was because of drugs. If you've had someone with drugs in your life, you can love them to absolute pieces, but it can be a little tempestuous at times, to say the least. And Train struggled with that. He was kind of an unknown musician when Davis took him in for what became the first great quintet. Davis had two. The second one happens later on in the 1960s, completely different personnel. And Coltrane was a Davis acolyte. I think Coltrane picked up, though, even more from Thelonious Monk. And by the time they get to the spring of 1960, which is when these recordings date from, Coltrane does not want to be in Miles Davis's band anymore. And Davis, this is big for him because it's his first tour as a leader in Europe. And that's a huge deal, was at the time, as a jazz musician. And Davis had had his own problems with drugs. He had to save his career, essentially, with a solo at Newport in 1955 on a Charlie Parker number. So he just wants this to go well. Davis was one of those artists who wanted to make a lot of money. Coltrane has already recorded, like, Giant Steps, Blue Train. He's doing his thing. And it gets absolutely crazy on so many levels on that tour, as you hear on these recordings.
And you point out in the piece, too, that at one point you can even hear audience members discussing and maybe even arguing about what they're hearing.
Davis was sort of a shaper of sound at this point. He was learning, and I think Coltrane was essential for him with this, how to basically be a writer through listening to what the people in his band were doing. So he would kind of take their ideas later, shape them, almost like an editor/writer. Train is at the front of the stage, and he is performing a kind of musical tray panning. Like, he is boring into your absolute skull to let the pressure out and let his sound in. And you hear, for instance, like in Paris early on, people do not know what to make of this. They're talking, they're booing, they're yelling, you hear them shuffling around because everyone is uncomfortable. And Davis is thinking, what's going on here? This isn't really how I want my tour to go. Train doesn't want to be there. It's very much like the premiere of Stravinsky's Rite of Spring, or if you've ever heard like an early 1985 15-minute concert from the Jesus and Mary chain, it's on YouTube, or Dylan at Manchester Free Trade Hall in the spring of 1966 when someone calls him Judas. It's a lot like that. And the intensity, the sort of ferality, is unprecedented in jazz to that point.
You talk about the gig they did in Copenhagen late on this tour, and Davis kind of let Coltrane do his thing. Was that maybe the best work Coltrane did, better than some of the work he did when he was by himself?
I wouldn't say so, because it's almost like when you are training for something, you might just go hog wild on your workouts and everything, but they're not very reined in, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And Coltrane is having that crazy, mad practice session, like in hockey when you skate killers and you go goal line to blue line, back to goal line, then goal line to red line, and on and on and on until you do the other goal line. He's basically doing that on stage. It is a torrent of notes. Like, he is overwhelmed by how much music is coming out of him. And it's really interesting, too, because you kind of have, like, almost like a hockey setup. You have these two studs on the first line. It's like having Crosby and Malkin, right? And then you have Wynton Kelly, who was this block chord soloing pianist, meaning he would have these chords right underneath the melody on the hard accents. And Davis is occupying sort of like the offbeat. Coltrane's above everyone. Jimmy Cobb was the perfect drummer for them because he swings. So he's adding that component. And then you have Paul Chambers, who is a very versatile bassist, kind of going along with the mood of what everyone else was doing. So it actually cohered, but someone got to Davis and Train after the early shows and said, look, you can't be doing this. This is nuts. Like, it's amazing theater, but the punters are playing the money and they want the chamber jazz. Scale it back a little.
As you look at this time together with Train and with Miles Davis, how do they rank with some of these other partnerships in the history of jazz?
Jazz is fascinating to me because I don't know of a musical medium where a duo, a partnership, means more. You have collaborations, of course, in everything, really, and certainly throughout music, Lennon, McCartney, all that, Richard Jagger. but it's not quite the same. A lot of times when you have people who write together in rock music, they don't actually write together. They write separately, and then they kind of vet each other's work. Partnership is a very real dynamic of jazz. So you have, like, Charlie Parker, Dizzy Gillespie, Ella Fitzgerald and Louis Armstrong, Lester Young and Billie Holiday, and one that I really like is Eric Dolphy and Booker Little. They made marvelous recordings in the early 60s together. Both men died, like, tragically early. But this dynamic between these two is perhaps the most impactful in terms of shaping the history. Even when they are apart, you have the feeling that they are partners in a way. Even after Coltrane dies, because during this period, in 1960, Coltrane is very much the dark mage, like the sorcerer out in front, albeit with acoustic music. Later, Davis will be the dark mage at the end of the 60s when he's doing fusion. He has electricity to bolster his sound, but I think even after Coltrane's death, he's informed by Coltrane. And the way that Davis would write with that second quintet, where he's letting Wayne Shorter do his thing and Herbie Hancock do his thing, and then shaping the overall sound. I think he learned that from listening to Train in 1960 as Train was at the front of the stage doing his wild stuff.
We were talking about another great jazz partnership the other day with Bob Ryan of the Boston Globe, and that was Chet Baker's work with Jerry Mulligan.
Oh, yes, West Coast jazz, those two. And, you know, I sometimes see Chet Baker maligned for his singing, which is absolutely crazy to me, because a lot of times people can be real hardos with jazz singing. They want you to have just an extreme amount of range, and I don't think you necessarily need an extreme amount of range. I think it's more how you deploy your voice. But, yeah, that's another one. But the entire history is just littered. Duke Ellington, Billy Strayhorn. And some people have, like, multiple partners because these careers. I mean, Duke Ellington, you can sort of go through his career and say, well, that was this marvelous bassist that Jimmy Blanton, that he overhauled sort of what swing music went. And Count Basie has a partnership with Lester Young, just one of my favorite tenor players. But in terms of the modern era, in terms of sort of bending the music to a shared creative will, Davis and Train were two musicians who couldn't be in a band, I don't feel like, for a very long time. It's almost like Davis was a sculptor, and he has his marble in front of him and the chisel and the hammer, and he's going at it, and it's coming out well, and boom, the arm pops off. And then it starts to grow on its own, and it's in the same room, and it's Coltrane. It's separate, in the same room, kind of like gesturing to each other, but not really a part of the whole, and maybe now is the time for us to go our separate ways because we've done enough here.
Check out Collins' two pieces on Miles Davis, John Coltrane, The Daily Beast, and Jazz Times. And next week, very excited about this, you've got a short story that is about to be published in Harper's. I can't wait to hear about that.
It is in the issue of Harper's, my friend, just out, the April 2018 issue, and took a while to get that one. They only published the 12 short stories a year, so it's a tough road to hoe. And you, as a teacher, can bust out all of your professory type of questions.
I look forward to it. That'll be next Tuesday, right here on Downtown. Thank you, Colin.
All right, thank you.
Colin Fleming, every Tuesday on the program.